But I'm kind of having to whisper at the moment. There we go. I'll just keep talking and they will do their magic up the back. So those of you who have listened to the last couple of sermons will know that we're in the number three in a series called Who's That? And in this series, we're looking at a few of the lesser known figures in the Bible, and we're wanting to highlight them. Because as we read the Bible, as we read other Christian books, as we grow in God, we learn a lot about the greats, don't we? The Davids, the Moses, Jesus should go without saying, but Paul, Timothy. And if we're brutally honest, I don't think very many of us can see the outworking of our kingdom calling in their lives, in their stories. I could be the only one. I recently went tramping with Adam, you'll know, kind of did the St. James Walkway, terrific. It had just been raining, and I really wished I could command the waters to part like Moses did and be able to walk through. But God doesn't seem to put his power on me to outwork in that way. And we came around a corner at one point and we saw a couple of wild pigs right on the track. And I have to say, I wished, a little bit of me wished that I had a slingshot and a couple of stones in my back pocket so I could, you know, do a David and get them. But just as equally, this is a public service announcement, I have been known to go 10-pin bowling and let go of the ball backwards. And people do a very quick dance out of the way. So Adam, who was behind me at the time, was equally glad I didn't have a slingshot and a couple of stones in my back pocket. But as I was preparing for this morning, I was thinking about someone like Onesiphorus. Who's heard of Onesiphorus? Oh, some of you. Not to be confused with Onesimus, who was the runaway slave that Paul writes about to Philemon. But Onesiphorus is someone that I can really relate to. You know, there are similarities in the couple of little portions that Paul writes to him that really echoes some of the ways that God outworks my calling. That when I look at what Onesiphorus does, I think, wow, I'm not weird, I'm just wired like that. I've just confused the letters a little bit. But, yeah, we're not going to do that. I changed my mind. I think Sam's going to, the other Sam, the big Sam, also known as Adam. So, Just a caveat, so I have empathy. My motherhood has been going on for 22 years now, so my babies are all very big and growing, but I do have a dog, and we were up all night with her vomiting. So I have had a little bit of a sleepless night. Can't blame it on any kids, but let's give me the grace of forgetting. So Sam, Toby, whoever you are up there, I think he's going to steal Onesiphorus anyway and maybe bring that message in a couple of weeks. But the reason why I changed my mind is I was writing the paper plane this week. Anybody read it? And what was the theme? Mother's Day. Celebrating those women who have been significant in our lives. And so I was starting to ponder on all of the women who have had an amazing impact on my life, who's really brought me to where I am now. And then some amazing men as well, not forgetting the guys, but it was Mother's Day, so I was pondering on the ladies. But then just because I was finding it very hard to focus this particular day, I then started thinking about Moses. And I thought, there are an awful lot of women who helped him, who really extended a hand to him in many different ways that helped him be who he was. So really, this sermon isn't called Who's That? But it's called Who's That? Because the Exodus story begins with seven very courageous women whose wisdom, their resilience, their faith in God challenged Pharaoh and paved the way for Moses' own deliverance and ultimately for Israel's deliverance through Moses. So have a moment to think, and don't turn to Exodus right now, but can you think of who these seven women might be? Who can identify at least two of the seven? Two, great. Oh, I've only got one hand for two of the women who might have helped. Oh, we've got a few. Who could identify three or four of the women? Excellent. What about five or six? You don't have to know them by name, it's all right. Six? What about seven? Yep, that's okay, but you've got kind of a good thing. Well, I think these seven women deserve a little bit of attention this morning. So we're going to be going and looking at them, and I'm going to be drawing from Exodus chapters 1 and 2. So if you want to go there, scroll through your... Isn't it funny how we've now gone right back and we're now scrolling with our modern devices? Or turn your page if you're old-fashioned. Okay, so most of us know the Genesis story, right? During creation, God tells humanity to be fruitful, to multiply, to go and fill the land. But there's a failure to keep God's commands, aren't there? And throughout the story, we then see a restart, which sees Noah building a big teva, a big ark, to keep the contents of the ark very safe inside it. And we see the covenants and the promises start to come down through the line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph until we get to the book of Exodus. And we find that that original command that we see right there to go and multiply has been happening. So if we go to Exodus 1 and we read those first few verses, we find that the Israelites have been doing exactly that. We're given the origins of the Hebrews in Egypt. They've descended from Jacob and his sons who settled there in the time of the great famine. But by verse 6, we're told that Joseph and that generation have all passed away until we get to verse 7. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly. They increased in numbers and they became so numerous that the land was filled with them. You know, the biblical authors there are directly paralleling what God had commanded mankind to do back in Genesis. But human nature then is the same as human nature is now. And we have a tendency to be scared of those who are a bit different from us, don't we? It tends to be our default. We struggle to trust other people's motives, maybe because we know our own hearts just a little bit too well. And where God would say that Israel's increase is a good thing, Pharaoh calls it bad. And Pharaoh feels threatened and he wonders about Israel's motives and their loyalty. And I think in counselling terms, I should have run this by you, but you were house-sitting all weekend, so I couldn't. I think in counselling terms, they might say this is a bit of transference because Pharaoh ends up dealing with the Israelites just as he fears that the Israelites would deal with him. And so here into the story enters our first two women, Shiphrah and poor. Who knows who they are in the story? The midwives, yes, the two midwives. So throughout history, you know, just like today, whenever an established power is not submitted to God's authority, they seek to dominate in all kinds of ways, to fear and emphasize differences, to other. Those people are different and other to us. They oppress. They make it harder for the other to succeed. They might outlaw cultural practices. They might incarcerate in large numbers. They might enforce mass deportations. They might send to extermination camps. Throughout history, this has happened. Before we go on to these women, I just want to point out what great irony there is here. Because Pharaoh orders Shipra and Puah to, for want of a better word, execute a population control strategy. If it is a son, he says, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. You know, this decree that Pharaoh had isn't an act of kindness. It's not merciful. We've already been told by the authors of Exodus that Pharaoh is a tyrant. He's willing to enslave, he's willing to brutalize the Israelites, but the girls, well, they're not going to raise up an army and come and defeat me, are they? So just leave them alone, the powerless, the weak, the not worth worrying about. Yet here in our story, there are seven who come together to save Moses, who God empowers to defeat Pharaoh's plan of death. So where Pharaoh has set himself up in opposition to God, enslaving the people and murdering their baby boys, we see the women of the story work to preserve and care for life. They wield a power that's unseen by Pharaoh, but man, it's immense in significance to the Israelite story, to our story. So, getting back to the main story of these midwives. We're not sure whether they were Hebrew or Egyptian, but we do know something about them. We know that they were courageous and that they defied Pharaoh because they, who knows why, they feared God. It was God they submitted to, and they let the boys live. And when Pharaoh realizes that there are Hebrew baby boys still popping up all over the place, he confronts the midwives and he says, "Hey, what is happening?" Well, Hebrew women are vigorous, I think most of your translations will say. They have their babies before we get there. And so Pharaoh's got to go back to the drawing board, because if he has such little control over what happens in the birthing room, he's got to try another tactic. And he makes not just the mechanisms of the state busy with his crimes against humanity, but he enlists the entire population as well. And if you're reading along, we're down in verse 22 of Exodus 1 now. Then Pharaoh gave his order to all the people. Every Hebrew boy has to be that is born. You must throw into the Nile. You must do my bidding, but let every girl live. Once again, of no significant threat, so girls are kept from the penalty of death. But here into the story come the next four women of significance. And I love the way, I really encourage you to go away and read the first two chapters as a whole after this and just see how the authors pull out these similarities and differences. But most people will be reading an NIV translation. And you will have something like this in Exodus chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. Has anybody got a translation that has something different to that? Yep, what's yours say? Perfect. So, some translations give a more literal translation of the Hebrew, and it says something exactly like what you've got. A man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. So then, hold that thought of a daughter. Then in verse 2, when Moses is born, it's Moses' mother, his mother looks at her son and sees he is what? He's a fine child. Some might say beautiful. But in Hebrew, it's the word tov. And we've heard it before. Back in Genesis, it's usually translated as good. You don't need to turn there, but throughout that first chapter of Genesis, that's the word that God uses after he's described something, looks at it and says, oh, that's tov. That's good. Like when God said, let there be light, and there was light, God saw that the light was good, tov. God saw the beasts of the earth, they were tov. So you get the idea. We're not expected to think here that Moses was a paragon of a baby and that he would take out first, second, and third prize of all the Egyptian baby pageants. What we're meant to think here is that he was exactly what God had in mind when he looked at mankind and said, be fruitful, multiply, and it's good. So once again, we have the setting up of Pharaoh's thoughts of creation opposing God's. Pharaoh's goal of destroying life against Moses' mother, who recognizes and seeks to protect this good gift of life that Moses is. And so then we know the next part of the story, don't we? She succeeds and she hides her baby for 3 months. Who here has lived with a 3-month-old baby, a 1, 2, or 3-month-old baby? Yeah. Who's lived next door to a 1, 2, or 3-month baby? They're pretty hard to hide. I tried to hide from mine a couple of times, I think. That's pretty hard too. But she succeeded. From all the eyes that were around, those who would have seen her pregnant, who would be able to hear through those walls until she could hide him no longer. And creating a waterproof vessel, a mini tevah, this time a mini ark. And this is only the second time that word is used in scripture to keep the contents of that ark safe. And she put Moses inside it and she put it in the Nile amongst the reeds. That's Exodus verse 3. Then we have another woman coming into Moses' life, and it's another daughter. At this time, Pharaoh's own. In verse 5, the Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. And she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her female slave to get it. Some translations might have handmaiden. But that's yet another woman involved. Another two women, isn't it? Pharaoh's daughter and her slave or maidservant involved in Moses' rescue. And what I love about this particular part of the story is how God is very careful to weave into the story of Exodus even those who in this life appear to have no agency or power of their own to act. This maidservant would have been under order. She had to go and do that. And yet her actions have been remembered and woven into this great story of the making of a nation. It's pretty cool. We serve a great God. Verse 6, she opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies. So in contrast to the hard-heartedness of her father, we have this Egyptian princess feeling compassion. And she rescues a boy that her father had sentenced to death by drawing him from the Nile, the very place that her father had commanded him to be thrown. And that's what the word Moses means, to be drawn out of or pulled out of, with the implication being somebody else has to do that work for him. So we've spoken about a slave and a couple of daughters. So now let's bring in a sister, Moses' sister. Thank you, who's ever doing the slides, because I'm forgetting. Great job. Miriam. So we came across her. We skipped over verse 4, but if you're going to go back and read the whole two chapters through at once, it's a great, great read. So in verse 4, we see his sister had been watching over her baby brother from a distance. And once again, there's a little bit of scholarly debate about how old she would have been about this time, but the general consensus is about 6, 7, or 8. So you think of these people up here this morning who are reading those mum jokes. You think of the courage it took for them to be up here in front of you. This is a little girl about the same age, courageously stepping up to the princess, to Pharaoh's daughter, and saying, hey, do you want me to find a Hebrew woman to look after the baby for you? If I was thinking that this girl was 13, 14, you know, that I can understand that. I was a bit bolshy at 13, 14, hasn't changed much. But a little girl of 6, it's true, isn't it, Abby? This little girl. And we know the plot twist here, don't we? Pharaoh's daughter agrees. Says, yes, I would like that. And not only that, hands him back to Moses' own mother and pays her a wage to keep him. But when Moses no longer needs to be nursed, he's been weaned, his mother returns him to the royal court, probably around 2 or 3 years old. And Pharaoh's daughter raises Moses as her own son. And through all this, Pharaoh fails to see the wisdom and the power displayed by these women. 6 women so far: Shipra, Pua, Moses' mother, Moses' sister, Pharaoh's daughter, and her maidservant. But that leaves us one more woman to put onto the list, doesn't it? 7. 7's a great number. If you haven't read this story recently, I'd really encourage you to go and read it. At some stage, Moses, growing up, goes on a bit of a tour of the city, and long story short, he ends up killing an Egyptian and needs to flee from Pharaoh. Verses 15 and 16. Pharaoh once again wants to kill him. And it says, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now, a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Now, if your antenna were not up beforehand at the mention of the word 7, you should have your little kind of ears pricked up. Because at that mention of the little number seven, we should know that something is coming up. And it is. It's the seventh woman on our list. But amongst these seven daughters, we have Zipporah, another daughter, the daughter of a Midianite, so not an Israelite. And she becomes Moses' wife. Now, those of us women here who are married will know that marriage does not save a man. However, through this connection, once again, Moses is delivered from death by a female hand. And it's a really strange story. I have to admit, I don't think I have ever heard anybody, I haven't preached on it, and I haven't ever heard a message preached on it because it's one of those really weird ones where Moses has come before God in the burning bush and God has declared, take off your shoes, this is holy ground, and he has given Moses the command to go back to Egypt so that all of his people might be set free. That's already happened. And Moses is being obedient. He's returning to Egypt to confront Pharaoh. And this happens in chapter 4. So we're still in Exodus, chapter 4, verses 24 to 26. At a lodging place on the way back to Egypt to do what the Lord has commanded Moses to do, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. Okay, where did that come from? But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me, she said. And so the Lord let him alone. At that time she said bridegroom of blood, referring to circumcision. So we could spend a few mornings preaching about all of the connotations and hit this. I'll say it could be a few times, but I think there's no just one could be. It's a combination of a whole bunch of these. But this interaction could have been a consequence for murdering the Egyptian. Or it could have been a consequence of failing to observe God's instruction to circumcise his son. And if you really do some study in it and you look at some of the Hebrew, there's some really, really interesting word choices that don't come up very often, but which cast our thoughts forward to the Passover and touching the blood to the doorposts as the angel of the Lord goes through Egypt. So it's really interesting. Whatever the significance, it's Zipporah who knows what to do. The Midianite, who's the wise person in this passage, she knows what to do and she intervenes to save Moses' life. So there you have it. Exodus, it's such an important book. We spent 20 weeks going through it last year. Was it last year? Year before, last year. It's in this book that God reveals his name and his character and his nature as Yahweh, the God who wants to have relationship with us. And it's in Exodus that we learn, as people of the new covenant of Christ's blood, how we are called to represent God amongst the nations now. It's in the book of Exodus that we see that the holy presence of God that we call on and say, come, Holy Spirit, come, is both a signal of blessing and great joy and great hope, but also danger. And we start to understand the significance of what Jesus did for us on the cross. It's in the book of Exodus that we start to understand that God's forgiving grace is our only true hope. And all of that, all of Exodus, starts with these seven women two midwives, a daughter of Levi who becomes Moses' mother, a daughter of Pharaoh and her maidservant, a sister and a wife, one a little girl. The midwives were presumably older women who had experience in childbirth. They were Hebrew. They were Egyptian. They were Midianite. This is a collage of women, just crossing class lines, family allegiances, racial, political differences, but a collage of women who unite to promote and preserve life. And it's from their actions that the story of Exodus really is born. You know, this is a collage of women who courageously oppose Pharaoh in his death-dealing ways. They choose instead to fear God and to partner with him in treating those God would call tov, good, with dignity. And as I read, I don't think any of those women would have set out to be heroes. You know, there was no earthly reward. There was no gain in status or expected just reward of any kind for their deeds. But they all courageously chose to do what was right in the eyes of God and uphold the value and dignity of all life. My takeaway, what can we take away? That God values us and our actions. That even when we don't feel that we have power and agency, not because of us, but because of who God is, he can weave our actions into his big story. You know, we may have no idea of the consequences of taking risks to stand up for injustice. But every day as we make decisions to look for what Jesus is doing, and to fear God, to get stuck in alongside what God is bringing about, he weaves our words and our deeds into his big story. And that is something that I can celebrate on Mother's Day. Can I have the team up? Can we have the team up?